from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of Americans choose big city life with all its headaches, thinking it's necessary to keep their careers on the fast track, to provide for their families, to stay plugged in to what's happening. But Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, says many people would be better off in small town, small city, middle America, and that the economy may soon push them there. Tonight on Point, Americans moving to greener pastures to find their dreams, to find the good life. But first, the death toll in California rose to 10 today in the La Conchita mudslide, 80 miles north of Los Angeles. Just before dawn, search teams found the bodies of a woman and her three children. More are still missing. This morning, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger toured the devastation in the town.
In the past few days, we have seen the power of nature cause damage and despair. But we will match that power with our own resolve, and we will come together as Californians and as neighbors.
The mudslide is tied to a wild weather system California has seen in the new year, with up to 19 feet of snow in the Sierra Nevada and flooding, road closings, and power outages up and down the coast. Alex Cohen is Los Angeles bureau chief for KQED Public Radio. She joins me now for a closer look at what's going on. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's the governor in La Conchita. That looks just about as bad as it gets. Is it still sliding down the mountainside?
Well, it's not still sliding down. It kind of came down in one big chunk Monday afternoon, but they're still working on clearing out all the debris it's left in its wake, which is just tons and tons of earth and mud and destroyed houses, cars, you name it.
For those of us who aren't Californians, the photos, the aerial photos, look just incredible. These enormous hills behind a little strip of town and then the ocean right there. It makes you think, what were they thinking? Was this thought to be a safe place?
Not really at all. This is not the first time that this has happened. There was a major landslide that happened about 10 years ago when the El Nino weather pattern had brought in a lot of storms. There was a similar landslide in the area that destroyed about 9 homes. But at that time, there were no lives lost. And as I talked to residents up there yesterday, they said that time it was kind of a more gradual thing. They knew it was coming. They were able to evacuate. This, everyone I talked to said, just came out of nowhere. It was literally, you heard the roar, and then it just happened. There was no time at all to evacuate.
You were in the town yesterday, I think. Do you see houses just, I don't know, up to the gills in mud?
You can't even see houses. What's really kind of eerie about it is that some of the houses in the town are perfectly fine. You know, some of them that were right down the street from once they've been perfectly destroyed are standing there in perfect condition. And then there's just this big heap of waste that they've just been pulling away with bulldozers, and they're still looking for survivors. There's still about 6 people unaccounted for, so they're still hard at work trying to search through all of that.
What happens to this real estate, valuable California real estate that's just been swamped with mud? Are they going to dig it out and lay out the lot lines again and rebuild, or is this finished? I mean, you look up that hillside, who would want to build there?
Well, the people who live there is basically what it comes down to. And that's the big question that everyone asks is, why would you live in this town? You know that this can happen. But even yesterday, what was really eerie is that despite all the storm and this terrible weather yesterday, at least for the first half of the day, it was beautiful and sunny. And if you kind of could block out the landslide, which was hard to do, you could understand perfectly why people want to live there. It's gorgeous. Your front yard is the Pacific Ocean. Yeah. You've got these big, beautiful green mountains behind you. One woman who is a longtime resident said it's like Oahu, and it kind of is right here in California. As for the future of this land, I think it might be a different story than what happened after 1995. I think, you know, some folks will be hard-pressed to make the cause for building there again because the land just is so unstable, and these are things that are very hard to account for. There is no such thing as landslide or mudslide insurance, so there's no kind of guarantee against the risk of it here. But then again, there are other people who spent their entire lives in this town, and that's all they know. I talked to one woman yesterday. I said, well, are you going to try to go back there? And she said, it's my home. Where else am I going to go?
Sounds like California in a nutshell, absolutely beautiful until it falls off. What about this wider weather pattern, Alex? Is this related, are the meteorologists and, I don't know, tectonic plate specialists saying, to the tsunami, to the earthquake off of Indonesia and everything that's come from that, or something else?
You know, I have to say I am not a meteorologist kind of expert, so I can't say whether or not this is at all connected to the tsunami, but this is part of the pattern. It happens from time to time. It's very rare, but the odd thing is, to date, even though it's been an incredibly wet season here in Southern California, so far it's only the 10th wettest season that they have on record. Now, of course, that could change because there's still many months left to this season, but this happens from time to time. I think what happens here in California is that there's a certain kind of psychological thing that happens, which is that we think we live in sunny Southern California, so that stuff like this can never happen. So everyone's kind of been in a state of disbelief. You know, this stuff happens, and no one knows what to do about it. No one knows how to drive in it, and it's because we're just not used to it at all.
And the mud is in the street. Alex Cohen, thanks very much for being
with us
tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Alex Cohen is Los Angeles Bureau Chief for KQED Public Radio. She spoke with us from Los Angeles. Forbes magazine publisher Rich Karlgaard grew up in North Dakota and headed for the big city. Now, he says, many Americans are headed back the other way, or should be. The high-flying 90s aren't coming back during your lifetime, he says. Relentless global competition will dampen American incomes for a generation. For boomers facing retirement or young families just starting out, thriving in the 21st century may take some creative solutions, like a move to Boise or Bismarck or dozens of other small cities and towns across the country. Clued in, Americans will take advantage of the wireless world, says Karlgaard, and cash in on the financial and social benefits of small-town living. For two summers, Rich Karlgaard flew his single-engine plane around the country to places like Green Bay, Lake Placid, Bozeman, and Des Moines, and met up with people who had traded in urban life for a new life in America's smaller cities and found financial success and personal happiness. This hour on Point, Americans moving to greener, cheaper pastures to find their dream, to find the good life. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling the financial squeeze of life in the big city? Are you ready to get out of town? And if you're already in small city, small town America, are you finding urban runaways on your block? Is it working for you, for them? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Palo Alto, California, is Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, author of the book Life 2.0, How People Across America Are Transforming Their Lives by Finding the Where of Their Happiness. Rich Karlgaard, thanks for being with us tonight.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
With me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you as well.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
So, Rich Karlgaard, here you are. We notice you're not living back in Bismarck. The return to sender address says Palo Alto, California. So what's up? You're not taking your own medicine here.
Well, Forbes is based in New York, and our second biggest operation is in Silicon Valley. And for a variety of reasons, I need to be here. But I was in Bismarck last week, and the town is hopping. It's hard to believe that a town could be hot when it was 16 below, but it is. And I'm about ready to go to Steve Forbes and negotiate some kind of an arrangement where I could he could cut my salary and I could live anywhere.
So make your case for us. You write that it sounds, on the one hand, upbeat, on the other hand, dire. You say a generation of Americans between the ages of 35 and 55 will experience life in much the same way our grandparents experienced the 1-2 punch of the 20s, a decade of promise that gave us skyscrapers, affordable cars and radios, and indoor electricity and plumbing for the majority, and then the 30s, the Great Depression, the opposite. That sounds pretty daunting.
We won't suffer in the same way, to be sure, but I think coming off of high expectations, where in the 90s, if you were an information worker, if you happened to live in California or Massachusetts or New York, you built into your expectation that you would be able to get rich and retire early. Many people did. Many people of ambition and education did just that. I think that 5 years since the beginnings of the erosion of the technology stock market in 2000, we're just now reconciling ourselves to the fact that that was a once-in-a-generation or maybe once-in-a-two-generation phenomenon, much like the 1920s were. Warren Buffett, of all people, the most famous stock investor in America, believes that we are in year five of about a 15-year secular bear market. Let us not forget that markets don't always go up. They, from 1966 to 1982, the market went from 1,000 to 777.
And that's just to get out of a bear market. You're writing that if you want to see something like the 90s again, you may have to wait 50 or 70 years. That's a stretch.
Yeah, well, I think it could be as long as that. I mean, the market from 1982 to 2000 went up about 15% per year. Can you imagine that? I mean, that wasn't that long ago, but those numbers look
like a miracle.
Himalayan right now. I mean, the average market return over the 20th century was about 7%. So the 82 to 2000 great bull market more than doubled that. And what happened was is that people began to build into their expectation that this is what markets did. So we mentally had this picture that we were going to retire at 55 or 60 and move to Florida or Aspen or wherever we liked based on our riches. And that is that simply isn't going to happen for the vast majority of us.
So you say get out of town. You write that it takes a family income of maybe $300,000 in Manhattan or Palo Alto, or $250,000 in Washington or Boston or L.A., or $150,000, maybe more, in Seattle or Atlanta, to enjoy a lifestyle comparable to a $75,000 family income in Des Moines. The cities may empty if you keep up this drumbeat.
That's my back-of-the-envelope calculation, and it was confirmed to me by the CEO of Coldwell Banker. Let me tell you two huge trends that are happening right under our nose. One, of course, I think is what consumes people at cocktail parties these days, and that is the price of real estate. It's going up everywhere. But right now, in 2005, the price gap between the urban coastal areas, between Boston, New York, California, versus the rest of the country is the widest it's been since we've measured this. And again, this fact was confirmed to me by the CEO of Coldwell Banker.
I want to be sure I've got that, Rich Cogger. You're saying the gap between what coastal, big city housing, real estate prices, and real estate prices in smaller towns and cities? Historic gap, historic yawning chasm there now?
Yeah, there's always been a gap, but the gap on a ratio basis is the widest that it's ever been. For instance, in the 1970s, when I graduated from high school in North Dakota and came out to school in Stanford, the gap was about 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. If you took a house and a property of identical size and accommodations in North Dakota and placed it in Palo Alto, it would cost 2 or 3 times as much. Now that gap is about 6 to 8 times as much.
Wow.
As I say, it's historically wide. And yet at the same time, the other big trend that is happening right under our nose is that the sophistication or information gap that used to be huge between the urban centers and the heartland has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. I mean, I can get the same cable TV. I can get the same national newspapers via the internet. I can make the same cell phone calls. I can get the same overnight delivery services in North Dakota as I can in California or New York. I'll give you an example that even surprised me. Last week, I was in my hometown of Bismarck giving a speech, and I stayed at my parents', and they had a bowl of wonderful avocados that were perfectly ripe in Bismarck, North Dakota, in January.
Right. What to make of that? That is not the old wild prairie winter you're talking about there.
Not at all. Where they could have come from Peru, who knows? But if you have a price gap that is historically wide and you have a shrinking sophistication gap, that creates an opportunity, I think, for a lot of people who are feeling pressed by the high cost of living and the high stresses of the urban coastal centers to think anew about moving to a smaller, less stressful community.
About getting out of town. Jack Beatty, Rich Colgard is saying, huge gap here. If you want to arbitrage it, if you want to take advantage of it, do it now. Because he writes, it will diminish that gap because it's at a historic high. So get out of town, buy that place way out there. What do you say?
Yes, and I can recommend some pornography in this. There's something called United Farms Real Estate. It's a real estate magazine about with real estate bargains in it in places like Nevada, Missouri, and Kickapoo, Iowa, and you wouldn't believe these houses. For $65,000 in Nevada, Missouri, you can buy a house that I think Mark Twain slept in on the Mississippi River, brick.
You too can be a baron, urban worker.
Absolutely. Pick up United Farms Real Estate and just oogle the pictures.
And yet, I wonder what they're going to think about you in Nevada, Missouri, and elsewhere right across. We'll talk about that. Rich Carlgaard, stick with us. We're glad to have you tonight. The new book is Life 2.0. We're talking about America. Americans moving to greener, cheaper pastures to find their dream, to find the good life. What do you think? Are you feeling the financial squeeze of life in the big city? Are you ready to get off the urban grid and live the small town life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Americans moving off the coast and out of big cities to find the good life. My guest tonight is Rich Karlgaard. He's publisher of Forbes magazine and author of the book Life 2.0, How People Across America Are Transforming Their Lives by Finding the Where of Their Happiness. Back in 1965, the adventures of a New York lawyer who gave up city life for country living were the stuff of the popular television series Green Acres. In this scene, the lawyer, played by Eddie Albert, explains why he made the move.
Sam said when you lived in New York, you were a lawyer.
Yes, I was.
Why'd you come out here?
Well, because all my life I wanted to be a farmer. I wanted to get away from the rat race of the city. Come out and breathe the fresh air. Live in the sunshine. Plant the little seeds in the rich brown earth. Watch them push themselves up through the soil, reaching up toward the blue sky and the sunshine till they become corn and wheat and alfalfa.
It's a nice speech.
Eddie Albert in 1965. Rich Karlgaard says, don't think it's all Cracker Barrels out there anymore. They've got high bandwidth internet connections and all the cable channels you've got. Listeners, you can join us tonight. City dwellers, does this sound like a realistic option to you? Could you take your work, your family, somewhere else? Have you already done it? And small towns, small city dwellers, is this your worst nightmare? A bunch of city folk moving in, driving up real estate prices, clogging up Main Street? Or is this a win-win migration? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Liddell is calling from Queens in New York City. Hi, Liddell.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Are you moving out of town, Liddell?
Well, my husband and I, who have a one-year-old, are thinking very seriously about it. And when I heard the topic of your show, it just rang so true. I picked up the phone and dialed. I listen a lot, but I very rarely make a call.
So how would you do it? Could you do the same work in small town, small city, USA? Could you take your city salary with you?
I guess it's very relative. We've been doing a lot of research. We're both in education. I'm staying at home at the moment with our child. We do own a co-op apartment, a two-bedroom, and
okay, doing
by
well.
Local standards, that's kind of spacious, you know.
Right.
But we feel that even the value of our very modest two-bedroom apartment has increased so much here in Queens, New York, that we could roll that over into a real home, and we've been doing a lot of research on the internet, and
Where are you thinking? Where are you looking, Liddell? Where might you go?
You're talking about small towns. I guess it's so relative, you know, being in Queens. We're thinking of a small town being like Rochester, New York. It's
right.
Just that, and that's the third largest city in this state. But I guess the anxiety is, is it really economically going to be okay in any of these places? And I guess if I had a question for Mr. Karlgaard, could he make recommendations? If we still need to be near a particular place and we don't want to get completely out of, like, the vicinity, are there places that he thinks are really up and coming, or are there places that really should be avoided?
Liddell, it's a great question, and let us pick it up. And Rich Karlgaard, let me preface, you get to play counselor here, but I have to say, reading your book, you talk to a lot of pretty high rollers who have done this. I mean, Michael Gartner, who, for heaven's sakes, head of NBC News, or, your pal George Gilder, I guess he's always been out there on that lovely road in Tyringham, or what is it, Doug Burgum, founder of Great Plains Software, worth $100 million. Liddell's in Queens. She and her husband are educators. She's saying, is the Karlgaard formula for me? What do you say?
Oh, I think it works. I think it works perfectly. One of the chapters in my book is about a laid-off insurance executive from suburban New York who moved to Des Moines, Iowa, and is living in a house of twice the size, 3,700 square feet. And he said that he and his wife have just been reborn. She's active in the arts community in Des Moines. Des Moines is about Rochester size. It's about 200,000 in population, metro 500,000. Liddell, I think upstate New York is an excellent choice. You know, it's been suffering for 30 years with the loss of manufacturing jobs, but that's built into the price of real estate. I believe that everything from here looks pretty good. Another place you ought to look at is the Albany area, because Albany is getting a heck of a lot of venture capital investment in nanotech and other areas, and could be a very fast-growing area with lots of job creation and housing appreciation.
But, Rich,
the Cornell area in Ithaca, I think, is going to boom, too.
But you say go for geographic arbitrage. That is, live in a small town, but get paid like you're in a big city. That's okay if you're a marketing executive who can do it over the phone, or you're a consultant who can zip off to Tokyo when you head out of Des Moines or Albany or Ithaca. But if you're a teacher and you move to the local teacher's paying scale, do you still gain?
Yes, you do if you pick the right town. I mean, this point about arbitrage is correct. If you can extract your dollars from New York or London or San Francisco and apply them to Lake Placid, New York, you've pulled off the perfect geographic arbitrage. But even in the case of a teacher, you cited my early example in the book, that it takes an income of about $300,000 in the New York area to match what $75,000, or even if I'm wrong, $100,000 in Des Moines would buy. $100,000 or $75,000 is about the total of two school teachers. And that's an upper middle class life in Des Moines. And that's not, I'll bet you don't feel like you're upper middle class in Queens, Liddell.
Maybe not. Liddell, it sounds like pack it up if you're in the mood and head north to upstate New York out of New York City, if that's what suits you. Let's get another call. Joy is calling from Millbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Joy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a New Yorker and now live an hour from Boston.
Yeah.
And I cannot see, my partner and I are far from retirement age, but I personally can't see myself going someplace smaller than I'm at right now, or further away from an urban center.
Why not?
From a diversity standpoint of the cultures, the people, the food. I know you the example of the avocados is great, but I don't want to FedEx in my food. I want to be able to drive and get Vietnamese and get get great sushi and get, and maybe it'll expand into those areas. I mean,
You think it's all spam out there beyond the Hudson River, Joy?
Well, I don't want to come across as a snob, but I mean, you have to understand that being in New York City and being able to walk every place within a square block, having every ethnic food that you want, now at least I have to go to Worcester and I drive, and that's okay. But, put me in the middle of the country, I'm afraid. Economically, it sounds great.
Right.
I'm in retail. My partner's a veterinarian, so
right.
We have very portable careers.
Oh, Green Acres in your future, if you could only live on the local diet. But Rich Carlgaard, is Joy got it right? Is she going to have to give up Vietnamese food and the pleasures of Manhattan if she moves to your Des Moines or Madison? Or does she really have to give that up these days?
Well, first of all, I mean, you can't replicate Manhattan. I mean, it is
kind of one of a kind.
The great seat of civilization, but it's at what price is increasingly the question. Let me tell you, in my travels over those two summers, I was astonished at the level of sophistication that expressed itself in education, work opportunities, grocery store offerings, restaurants in smaller and smaller places. I think one of the last publicly acceptable prejudices is for urban sophisticates to think that it's somehow that these things civilization lacks out there. I think that's a lagging perception, particularly in university towns. I mean, the find of the book is that university towns really have it all. Towns like Madison, Wisconsin, Bozeman, Montana, amazing selection of grocery stores, health food stores, great restaurants, and so on, bumping into sophisticated people, and yet without the cost and the status competitions and so on that really can add a lot of stress if you live in Manhattan.
Status competition. We've got to come back and look at that. You know, I have to say...
I'm stealing a Tom Wolfe phrase, I'm afraid, here.
Right.
I'll admit
it'll
it right
work.
Up.
It'll work. It was 30 years ago... I headed out of one of the towns that you now point to as a place to move to, Bloomington, Illinois. And my parents took me over to Peoria, put me on a hog truck, and sent me east. And I've lived in, a good portion of the biggest cities in the world since then. But now when I go home, back to, they're right in the middle of Illinois, and it's a two-university town, and they've got all kinds of ethnic restaurants and just... incredible variety of culture.
It really
going
has
on.
Changed, hasn't it?
It's changed it is, a lot.
Yeah.
It's changed a lot. And Jack Beatty, here you are. You're in the studio with me tonight, but most nights you're in Hanover, New Hampshire, and I know you haven't always lived there on the bluffs above the beautiful Connecticut River. What's your exurban experience been, Jack?
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, we live in the Dartmouth area. I'm a mile from
Dartmouth College.
Yeah. And my wife today, for example, went to a lecture in the afternoon at the Hood Museum, which is a fine museum, mm-hmm. on the art of the Plains Indians. And we can see a foreign film. And, yes, there are many people who have very interesting backgrounds and so on.
So are you inviting the population of Boston, New York, Baltimore, Philly, everybody else to come up and camp out with you?
On the other hand, it's a culinary desert.
Whoops.
Forgive me for being so blunt. But other than
That's why we have cooking channels on cable TV.
I think that's why. But, you know, the fact is competition does tend to make people better at what they do. And Manhattan is a great place to eat, San Francisco, because there's competition. I'm afraid as you get into even university towns, there just isn't the competition to drive the level of excellence. And if you want just a meal that tastes... well, we've had to go 35 and 40 miles, and we are not, you know, fancy eaters. I'm just talking about a
sure?
bowl
do,
of
Do you feel
pasta.
Like a snob saying that, Jack? Are you sure? I mean, what is it? Is it just boiled cabbage?
No, it just doesn't have any taste. You know what I mean?
Oh,
people are afraid to season it. It's a kind of bland, and you wouldn't get away with it in Manhattan. The competition would just put you out of business.
Yeah, I don't know. Rich Carlgaard, how about it? You flew that little plane all over the USA. You did a lot of drinking, you write about. Is that because you couldn't find a meal you
Flying and drinking, no, is to cause my nerves. In fact, this has caused me all kinds of problems since the book came out, my life insurance policy and everything.
Right.
Everybody's shaking their head
take
at
the
me.
Take the stick away from that guy.
Yeah, I know. I was inspired, Jack, by the way, to take up flying because of stories that your colleague Jim Fallows has written and over the last 5 years. But I can't lay the drinking to Jim.
The great promoter of personal flight. But we won't all have those single-engine airplanes.
But what about the restaurants?
Yeah, how about it, Richard?
The restaurant. Well, I think, you're right in there that they're spotty. I mean, I think that it's sort of in a town like Madison, there are a handful of good ones. In Manhattan, you bump into a good one. You stumble in a good one the same way you do in Florence or some of the great culinary centers. That is true. But what we were talking about earlier, what Tom was saying, that Bloomington, Illinois is not the same Bloomington, Illinois. That's really what's going on here, is that the general level of sophistication in terms of arts and food and the sophistication of people that you meet is just much higher. The provincialism is not what it used to be. I would love to spend another hour talking about the fallacy of this red state, blue state phenomenon that is so in the news today, too, because I think having traveled around, that's a gross exaggeration of what's really going on.
Well, we're
going
to have to talk about that because we've had some very interesting people on this show on just that subject. But let's get another call first. Sharif is calling from Boston. Hi, Sharif. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess the next step, following on the last call, is not just food and not just culture sort of abstractly, but my wife and I are of Middle Eastern origin and Muslim faith. If we want to move to one of these cities, what likelihood is there that we can find a like-minded community, a community of similar or at least close to similar ethnicity, religion, that we can try to raise our kids with some of those people, that there might even be schools of that religion? I guess that's the thing that really concerns me. The economics make sense, and I understand the sophistication gap issue, but I guess in terms of community for someone of ethnic or ethnic or religious minority, that concerns me.
And Sharif, let me ask you, is your concern about finding others of your faith or your country of origin, or is it about whether or not you'll find tolerance?
No, I'm not worried about the tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about...
just diversity, really.
Yeah, the people of the same community.
Rich Carlgaard, how about it?
Well, one of the great things about the United States is the sheer diversity of places that we can live in. We can live on the coast. We can live in the mountains. We can pick our places by weather. We can pick our places by political tenor or ethnicity. I don't know. I haven't done the research on your specific case, Sharif, but to take two cities of similar size, Minneapolis and Cincinnati. I found that Minneapolis is a very open, tolerant city. And as a consequence of that, it is growing in all the places you would want it to grow, the high-tech, low-polluting, high-paying kinds of jobs. And Cincinnati is struggling to keep 100,000 university students that are within an hour's drive of the city core close to it because there is just a kind of hidebound conservatism there that is not appealing, particularly to people of color or different lifestyles. I think, you know, Americans are very adaptive, and so are community leaders. If you want to do well in this information economy, Professor Richard Florida and others have pointed this out, you don't want to cut yourself off to talent of any kind. And the more progressive communities have figured that out. It's, again, why I think that university towns and cities are really the places in the United States that combine it all.
Sharif, thanks for calling. Rich Colgard, you say about Cincinnati, it's a town that made me realize that there are thousands of communities that will not be successful in their bid to gain new transplants from urban areas precisely because of that kind of lack of diversity you're talking about. But I'm wondering, as we talk tonight, we've got listeners, you know, in the biggest cities in the country and in very small places as well, listening in Washington State or Wisconsin or Kentucky or the Carolinas. Is this a good deal, this out-migration from urban America? Is it a good deal for the people already living in these smaller towns and cities? Is it good for them or not?
I think so, but I run into this question a lot. For instance, when I was in Bozeman, Montana earlier this year giving a speech, Bozeman is a perfectly lovely place, the trout fishing, skiing, even pretty moderate weather in the winter because it's far enough west in Montana, it gets the Chinook winds, not the horrible Arctic freezing from the plains. And there are a number of people in Bozeman that like it just the way it is and don't want all of this high-tech growth. But my answer to that is that you're going to get the growth anyway. People are going to discover you. They're going to arbitrage the real estate price differences. The question is whether you want to be servants to a bunch of rich Californians moving in or you want to create real opportunity for your children going forward.
Is it an either-or opportunity here?
I think it is. I mean, either I think you welcome a certain kind of growth and immigrants or you're going to be the kinds of place where you're going to drive up the costs anyway and only rich people with hobby ranches are going to be moving in.
So open arms does what for the local economy?
Well, I think open arms refreshes the economy. The most creative entrepreneurial thinkers are often the people with a fresh perspective who are moving in and seeing opportunities that some of the locals don't have. You know, the opposite is Burlington, Vermont. Now, a lot of people like Burlington, Vermont, except that people who are natives to Burlington, Vermont are not so happy about rich New Yorkers and people from Boston coming in and driving up the prices. You know, the answer to that, I think, is to create economic growth.
And you write about a lot of people who have done just that. Rich Colgard is with us. His new book is Life 2.0. You can join the conversation. Do you feel the pinch that Rich Colgard is describing? Do you feel the pull of small town America? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Maybe putting on my walking shoes here, Jack. I don't know. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Americans moving out of cities and off the coasts to find the good life. My guest is Rich Colgard, publisher of Forbes magazine. He writes the column there, Digital Rules, focusing on the intersection of technology, economics, and public policy. He's author of Life 2.0, How People Across America Are Transforming Their Lives by Finding the Where of Their Happiness. What do you think? Is this the next great migration out of the cities and into the wild blue yonder? Is it already happening? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Courtney's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Courtney. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
There's another trend that's afoot that is an attempt to try to get your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
And that would be escaping from certain kind of cities and going to other types of cities like Portland that is trying to have natural amenities and affordable housing and manage the growth.
And hasn't always been welcoming of the influx.
Well, they knew that it was coming, and they said it's coming. You know, the Californication is coming our way. So they created something called Manage the Growth, Urban Growth Boundary. And, of course, you may know they shot that down recently.
But are you saying this is a problem or an opportunity, or what's your attitude? So you want to move out of your city and go to Portland. Is that a problem?
Well, what they did is they said, look, you know, we're going to have this onslaught. We're going to preserve our farmland, but also create higher density affordable housing with mass transit and walkability and transit-oriented design. And we're going to have beautiful townscape and open, you know, walkability and parks and vistas to mountains around.
Right.
They created a beautiful town that has everything. But it's not sprawl. It's not this sort of car-oriented, driven, high-energy use.
Not just to recreate that. We've got it, Courtney. Rich Colgard, how about it? Can this be a win-win? Does your recipe for out-migration mean urban sprawl for the small towns and cities you're celebrating?
No, I mean, I think what's been pointed out by Courtney is really an example of the great diversity that exists within the United States. Suppose you are a Californian and you're feeling crushed by the cost of real estate, the long commutes that are getting longer, and so on. Here you have a couple of choices that couldn't be more different from each other: Las Vegas and Portland, Oregon. You know, if you are left of center, if you like all the things that Courtney is talking about, Portland's a great place to go try out. Your dollar sure will go a lot farther. If you like the go-go economic situation, you want to build a business very fast, you like the action, Las Vegas happens to be the fastest growing metro area in the United States right now. Las Vegas has 2 million people now. It's just an amazing story. But this is what's so great about this country, is that you can pick your communities, and now with technology, why not do it?
And yet, a lot of what you're describing here, you say, is premised on kind of economic hard times. One of your headings: gone is the assumption of rising income. It's sort of moving back to the provinces because the economy is not floating the boats up at the level that kept the urban life going, all gilded.
I think, you know, I'm pretty much an optimist at most times, but when I think about the future of the urban middle class, I think it's going to get tougher and tougher. We do live in a world where, as one of my Forbes colleagues who lives in Shanghai says, that is affected by the China price. More and more goods and services that are produced in the United States now have to meet the China price or the India price. That means that companies are going to have to stay lean. Even in this economic recovery, we're finding that big companies are not hiring robustly. Raises are not matching the GDP growth gains. Stock options have not appreciated much. The 90s are gone. It's a different sort of economy. It's an economy that rewards flexibility and small scale entrepreneurism and different kinds of factors. But a lot of people in the urban middle class, I think, are going to be increasingly pressed.
So in a way, you're describing a kind of survival strategy to keep the American dream alive. Instead of moving up, move out to where the cost of doing it is just less. Sheila's calling from New York City. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a playwright in Brooklyn, and my fiance is a composer. And, of course, the rents are exorbitant here so much that we have to have a roommate, and we're talking about moving. And I wonder what your recommendation is for people whose vocations are collaborative in nature and require the artist's presence for the job, keeping in mind that artists notoriously don't make huge salaries, and we're lucky to be late making a living right now in the city as is.
Got it. Sheila, good. So what about, she's a playwright. You know, how can she be away from the stages, the actors, the rest?
Well, it's a good question, Sheila. What you have to ask yourself is, how many days a week do you really need to be in the city? Many people, here's a trend I will predict on the air that I didn't really articulate in the book, but I think more and more people who have jobs that seem to be rooted in an office or seem to be rooted in some necessary collaborative situation, as Sheila describes, will find with broadband technology and other technologies coming down the pike that they really can still do it with fewer face contact. It isn't a black and white world, in other words. It may be that you only have to go into your office one day a week or 2 days a week. And
But the penniless artists, are they going to be teleconferencing with their mates, you know, off Broadway?
You know, yesterday Steve Jobs introduced the Macintosh for $499.
Yeah.
300 million people in China bought cell phones last year. So the technology is becoming cheaper and more accessible. Yeah. And the question will be, you know, can you live in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, which is a perfectly lovely community about 2 hours away from Manhattan, and go in one day a week or 2 days a week and crash at some crash pad or some mm-hmm. friends and mm-hmm. do the collaborative work that is necessary.
And fire up your $300 Applejack. How about it? You're a creative guy, got a creative wife up there on the bluff, over the river. Is it all working?
Well, let me just give our friend from Brooklyn some advice. The city of Troy, New York, is actually trying to do an artist revival as a city revival strategy. Mm. They make at preferred rates. They made studios available to artists. The local college there, Russell Sage, was actually giving people $5,000 bonuses. This is just a couple of years ago to move in. We saw a house, a townhouse on a private park, one of the few in New York City. This would be 3 years ago now. That was $270,000 for basically 6,000 square feet of house.
Oh, boy.
And in Albany, we saw a house 3 years ago that was an arts and crafts mansion, practically, for $280,000.
You still got to heat it in the winter, Jeff.
You got to heat it in the winter. But this Troy thing, and then also they have a big performing arts center. In other words, there are cities that are actually trying to use the arts as development.
Rich Colgar, we just got 1 minute left. When do you think the rubber is going to hit the road here? Is it right now? Are people moving from the cities to small town, small city America? Or are we going to see a migration, I don't know, explode in the next few years?
I think we'll see a trend that is detectable now become a much bigger trend. The average baby boomer will hit 50 this year, and they're looking into the future and looking at their 401ks right now, which might more properly be described as 201ks, and they're beginning to see this arbitrage opportunity, and I think it will grow significant.
You think they're going to go right off the U.S., Matt? Maybe they'll be in, I don't know, Belize or Honduras to make that 101k work.
I have a chapter about a PR couple from San Francisco who moved to Turks and Caicos, and now they not only have a beachfront home in Turks and Caicos, they also have a mountain chalet in Vermont. They've done so well.
Living large, way out there. Rich Colgar, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Rich Colgar, publisher of Forbes magazine, joined us from Palo Alto, not from Bismarck, North Dakota, but maybe one day. He's author of Life 2.0. How people across America are transforming their lives by finding the where of their happiness. A list of 150 cities at the back of the book and what you might think of each of those cities and towns. Jack, we can just get out the dart and start throwing it at the big old map of the USA here. Great
yes,
to have you.
And I'm not on some bluff over the river. You can't even see the river.
Oh,
please.
Well, it was just a bluff. This is On Point. Severe weather has been making headlines across the West. The weather was the big story on this date in 1888 as well. On that January 12th, a sudden severe storm swept into the upper prairie states. It had been an unusually mild morning. Most people were out and about. And then temperatures dropped 18 degrees in just 3 minutes. And a blinding mix of hurricane force winds and horizontal snow created near zero visibility. By the next day, hundreds were dead, including 100 children who had been trying to make it home from school. And the country's sense of prairie life would never be the same. Writer David Laskin has drawn on oral and written accounts to tell the story of that massive storm in his new book, The Children's Blizzard. Tonight, he reads a passage from his book and explains how the blizzard of 1888 marked a turning point for the American prairie.
This storm came toward the end of what was known as the Dakota Boom. This was a period starting from about the late 1870s and crescendoing really through the 1880s when there was massive migration to the prairie, and the Dakotas, which were not yet two states but just a territory in particular, were filling up with homesteaders. There was a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm for settling this new country, and land was free, and the railroads had a lot of land, and they were selling it for very low prices. So settlers came pouring in, and for a while conditions were pretty good, and you know, there was grasshoppers and prairie fires and things like that, but people were kind of making a go of it. And then this storm hit in 1888, and it really was kind of the beginning of the end of that period of enthusiasm and that sense of optimism on the prairie. So I think it marked a turning point to this period of bitterness and hardship. And as we all know, this region has been losing population recently, and this whole kind of sense of decline and dealing with very harsh and unforgiving environment lodged itself into people's minds after the storm. And I think part of what happened was that so many of the victims were children. And I think that just made it particularly heartbreaking and particularly cruel. This is a passage from The Children's Blizzard about an 8-year-old schoolboy named Walter Allen who gets lost in the storm. Walter has become separated from his classmates, and this is how his story progresses. "The world is full of nothing," ran inanely through 8-year-old Walter's mind. He experienced that little seizure that tightens around the heart when you first realize you've taken a step that you cannot reverse. Snow clogged his nostrils and coated his eyelashes. Snow blew down the neck of his coat and up his sleeves. The air was so full of powdered ice crystals, and it was moving so fast that Walter had trouble filling his lungs. The exposed skin of his face and neck felt seared, as if the wind carried fire, not ice. A cottony numbness spread through his body and brain. It did not occur to Walter that he could still take shelter in the schoolhouse. Though he could barely see or breathe, he decided to set out for home. Once he made that decision, a door shut behind him. After a dozen steps into the storm, he could not have returned to the schoolhouse if he wanted to. Countless witnesses wrote that visibility was so poor at the height of the blizzard that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. This would explain how a woman near Sioux Falls, South Dakota, froze to death with her key in her hand just steps from her door, and the husband and wife who both perished while blindly circling each other in their farmyard. So it's hardly surprising that 8-year-old Walter Allen became confused and disoriented when he rushed out of the school and found himself alone in the storm. Even worse than the whiteout was the agony of his eyes when he tried to see through the snow. The fine, hard pellets blew into his eyes and made them water. Walter cried, and the snow mixed with his tears until it formed a crust between the upper and lower lids. Instinctively, he reached up to brush the crust away with the back of his hand. Soon his eyeballs were inflamed, which further distorted his vision. The pain became so acute that it felt better to let the ice crust build. Tears and blowing snow melded together and sealed his eyes shut tightly. There was no way to break the seal except by tearing the tender skin. Walter stumbled. The sizzle of driving snow hummed in his ears, and the frozen needles cut his face and throat. He knew he was lost. It was probably only a matter of minutes before he collapsed, whether in a gust of wind, or because his feet became too frozen to bear his weight, or from simple exhaustion, we'll never know. Strangely, once he was down, everything was better. On the ground, the snow was softer, and the wind didn't blow so hard. Walter curled up in the snow and surrendered.
David Laskin reading from his new book, The Children's Blizzard, an account of the Great Prairie Blizzard of 1888. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.